You're listening to the Low World Podcast, number 88. My name is Sean Wildermuth, and I am your host. The Hello World Podcast is where you can hear from some of your favorite developers, authors, and speakers about how they got started in this business and the decisions they made along the way. We go way back to their first computer, first code experience, and their first job. With this episode, it only leaves a dozen episodes left. Yes, we're ending the podcast after 100 episodes. The last episode will be Richard Campbell interviewing me about how I got started. I can't wait for you to hear it. We've decided not to have a sponsor for the podcast, but if you would like to support the podcast and the other things that I do, feel free to visit my Pluralsight courses at seanw.me/psauthor, including my newest course on ASP.NET Core using Visual Studio Code. On today's show, we have Mads Torgerson. Mads is the program manager for the C# language. He maintains the language specification and runs the language design process for C#. Many years ago, Mads was a professor and also contributed to a language starting with J. I was really excited to meet Mads, as I've heard about him for a long time, especially his work around the C# language, which of course is close to my heart. We had a great conversation about his love of languages and the difference between working for Microsoft and when he was a professor. I think there's some interesting lessons there, and I hope you'll find some insight like I did. Let's take a listen. Well, today I'm excited to have Mads Torgerson on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Excited to be here.
And you're in Seattle?
Close enough, yes. I'm in Redmond at the Microsoft headquarters.
Oh, okay. Great. Great. And you've been with Microsoft quite a while now, or?
Yeah, we're just coming up on my 12th anniversary.
Wow. Wow. And you work on the .NET team, or are you on the language team with everyone over there in C#? I forget.
Yeah, it's organizations change, you know, but right now it's sort of the same thing. There's a .NET. I'm a program manager, so I'm on the PM team, and there's a .NET PM team that I'm on.
Oh,
so
okay, cool.
We're language and Visual Studio implementation of the languages together with the .NET runtime and framework and .NET Core and ASP.NET and all that stuff all on the same team.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. So you probably know what question's coming next, and that is, you know, did you grow up with a computer in the house, or one that you played with in the neighborhood?
I did not grow up with a computer in my house. I did grow up with a computer scientist in the house, though. my dad, after having gone through various different engineering disciplines, ended up studying computer science when I was little. And so the notion of computers was in my home, but we didn't have one because people didn't have computers back then in their homes. So it was only when I got to around 8th grade or something like that I started to play with the VIC-20s that they bought at the school, and I decided I wanted my own little computer and got sort of one of those little rubber keyboard computers you could get back then and started hacking around in its version of BASIC.
And was it love immediately, or was there a moment when you became really excited about programming?
I can't really tell when I don't even know when I wrote my first program. I think the school had VIC-20s that were probably where I wrote my first real program in a real programming language. But I did have a friend who had, he had a Spectrum.
Uh-huh.
There was a text adventure writing tool there that you could, you could program your own text adventures.
So
I think that was my first programming experience per se.
So this was back in the days of Zork and,
Yes, exactly. Those wonderful, you know, text adventures where you type little commands. And some of them, the advanced ones, would have graphics. You know, they would draw little vector graphics on the screen. It would take forever to show you a horrible still image of whatever room in the cave or castle you were currently at.
I don't know if you've tried, but the first three Zorks are online where you can just play them in a browser now.
Yeah, I heard. I haven't actually tried. The funny thing about it was I didn't actually enjoy text adventures very much. I never really got compelled by them much. The thing that I think that's probably what sealed my fate was it was more fun programming them than actually playing them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of people have been caught up in that way.
Yeah.
And did you decide pretty soon that that's what you wanted to go to school for, or did you just start working? What's that story like?
Yeah, so it was always a hobby for me to do some programming on the side, but I had lots of interests, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do after high school. For a while, I was sure it certainly wasn't going to be computer science. But I had many interests. I played music, and I was kind of interested in studying maybe ethnography or religious studies, or some more like arts related stuff. And it was only at the last moment when, okay, you really got to apply. And, you know, in Denmark, you apply for a specific line of study immediately when you go to university. So I had to pick before I applied. And I ended up deciding, all right, this computer science thing seems to be the one that fascinates me the most. And I went down that path. But it was a last-minute decision.
That's funny. A last-minute decision that has affected your whole life.
Oh, yeah, that's often how it goes, isn't it?
It is. It is. And did you know pretty quickly in college that you felt good about that decision?
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I was super taken by it. And it wasn't long before I started homing in on programming languages being the thing that was interesting for me. I quickly got involved with a programming language that was developed locally. It was called Beta. Nobody ever used it anywhere else. But it was its claim to fame was that it was originally started by Kristen Nygaard, who was the famous father of object-oriented programming and the Simula programming language.
Yeah,
sort of his attempt to try again in a more making a more general. More sort of conceptually unified programming language than Simula, and somehow that got picked up particularly at my university in Aarhus in Denmark, and I got to work on that, work with that.
Wow, that's awesome.
As a student programmer, so I was really digging the programming language thing.
It's interesting because there seems to be sort of a common thread. You didn't like to play. Text adventures, but you liked creating them, and I guess that wasn't enough for you, so you said, instead of creating software for people to use, I'm going to create the software that people that write software use.
Yeah, you can say that. It's you're getting deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole there. Maybe one day I'll be making tools for programming language designers.
Yeah, maybe that's the next step. And so did you you were using this language at college. Were you sort of one of these polyglots early on that you wanted to try every language to kind of get a sense of since you were going down this liking to work on actual languages, or were you really just fascinated by Beta?
I was always Beta was a particularly interesting. Thing for me to encounter, but because it was sort of taking some concepts and really running with them. And I think it's always fascinated me in that sense. It was more an academic exercise than a practical programming language. When you run into some of those that are like extremely pure in a certain direction,
sure,
that's really fascinating. You can see sort of the ideal endpoint of some line of thought that in most practical programming languages only sort of goes a bit of the way. And Beta was that for object-oriented programming. It really unified things like methods and classes were the same construct. They weren't two different constructs. And so it's sort of like a this is mind-boggling, and I can kind of see a deep truth there that's interesting to learn and to internalize. And so I like that in different directions. You do the same thing with functional programming. You go use Haskell, and even though Haskell programmers claim that it's the most practical language to use for many things, you know, the main benefit of Haskell, certainly what has had the most impact in the world, is that it's such a pure embodiment of a particular conceptual framework, if you will, that if you go use it and play with it, you get really, really clear sense of that functional paradigm that you can then go and make use of in a more practical setting.
Oh, that makes sense. That makes sense. I've been doing a bunch of research around sort of language use, because there's some colleges in the U.S. that are switching what languages they're teaching for, you know, their first computer science class, in order to make it more approachable and less, not necessarily less practical, but more where you can get more done with less. You know, some are going to Python, some are going to Java, and so I'm fascinated with sort of this idea of language choice, or language, you know, what attracts you as a computer guy or girl. I think says a lot about the kind of developer you are. And because you were so passionate about languages, I think that says a whole lot.
Yeah, I think that I think that a lot of that depends. I mean, some people just get attracted to a language. They feel good about it and they can get stuff done in it or whatever. But I think there's an aspect of what are you using the language for? And I think that in the software development world, well, we say like, duh, you use it to develop software. But when you're in, you mentioned like teaching languages, when you're in college, you don't necessarily use the language in order to get stuff done, like to build something. You use it to learn.
Yeah.
And sometimes taking the leading industry language at the time, like maybe Java was for a long while there, just teaching that to people, well, it may make them good Java programmers, and certainly they will learn the way around Java, and they can go and be software engineers, I guess, with that language. But sometimes what you want to get through isn't like just a skill; it's some insight and some learning. And sometimes there are some languages that are just more for that than for actual software development.
Yeah,
and I think I have a certain special place in my heart for those, because of that. Some of the good ones really get you to that aha moment that you can carry with you and use when you need to get your fingers dirty in the real world.
So let's sort of talk about that. You were in college. Did you immediately start working when you left college, or even maybe before you left college, like internships?
I did not. I was not close to industry for a long while. I worked as a student programmer, but that was at the university, and I also worked sometimes as a teaching assistant and so on. Mm-hmm. And then I decided that I wanted to become a researcher, and I continued taking a PhD and started teaching both as a PhD student, and then I got a job as an assistant professor and then associate professor. I totally fashioned myself a programming language researcher, because I had this fascination with sort of the underlying principles and getting to the bottom of things and so on. So that's the track I was on, and I kind of I don't want to say burned out on that, but I think I realized that there's a big downside to that track, which was that you were, as a researcher, I found that I was doing things that essentially had no impact for anyone. So it was, in a way, nobody would directly, I would be lucky if anyone would ever use the direct results of my research work. And also it was a very lonely kind of job where you would have occasional collaborations, but on the whole, there was a lot of lone wolf kind of aspect to it, and also it didn't pay super well. So I got there was a thing that sort of really changed my perspective on it, which was that I ended up having really good contacts at Sun Microsystems, where I got early on as a PhD student, I got involved in the whole Java generics effort, which was actually a very admirable outreach from people at Sun Microsystems, from Guy Steele and others, to the research community to say, let's really discuss this generics thing. And they encourage people to try different things out and make prototypes and so on, and had a long, but I think very fruitful process of developing what became Java Generics. And I was super lucky to get pulled into that and got good contacts around that. I ended up during the Java Generics thing, I ended up getting a grant from Sun Microsystems to run a little project at my university with some student programmers to develop the wildcards aspect of Java Generics,
is
intellectually fascinating, although people hate it as a programming construct. So I got more and more into the industry thing, and it really, really, even though I started out hating Java, oh, it's so impure, oh, it's so verbose, you know, I gradually got hooked on the impact aspect of it. Hey, you're working on something that really makes a difference to people, and if you do it well, you're making their lives better. And there's this feedback loop, and this is an actual tool that, you know, plays a big role in people's lives. And I kind of got the first jolt of that, and that was very interesting to me. And it slowly dawned on me that I needed to make that my core thing in life, and not something I did on the side when I was lucky enough to find an industrial collaborator.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. And so you made the decision at some point to, sort of move more into industry and sort of leave academia. Did you finish your PhD?
I finished my PhD and I worked for 4 years after that. So it was a slow process.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
But I made the decision at some point to sort of just start looking. And then I was insanely lucky. I've been lucky a few times. Like, I was lucky getting involved in that Java generics thing in the first place as a very young researcher, one of the youngest and greenest that was in that thing. But I got lucky again. There was a conference in my hometown in Aarhus in Denmark, called at the time JAU. It's now the go-to conference. It still exists.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Used to be a Java conference. This was the first year where they wanted to expand and also include .NET and Microsoft things. And they invited this guy over called Anders Heilsberg to give a talk about C# generics.
I think I've heard of him.
Yeah, I'd heard his name a few times before. I was like, hey, they also had me come talk about Java generics, and I met Anders. We went to each other's talks. We got talking, and I tried to make it as clear as possible that I was up for grabs. and sure enough, a couple of weeks later, I got invited to Redmond for an interview loop, and that's where it all happened.
Oh, wow. So what was
I didn't even have to look for long. I mean, how lucky is that? You're interested in programming languages. How many people make a full-time living out of working on programming languages? That's a
not
minuscule
a lot. Yeah.
Segment of our industry. So I was just incredibly lucky there.
And so in your work and research in programming languages, you're more on the side of designing the language than building the compiler, or is it all, you know, wrapped up in each other?
It's closely connected, but I'm definitely on the side of designing the language. That is my official, like, duty at Microsoft is to make sure that we design C# well.
Sure.
And in practice, of course, there's a close relationship between especially the compiler and the language, also the IDE and all the tools that work with the language.
Yeah.
As you know, we've sort of unified, we've turned the compiler into sort of a unified language engine that has a very nice public API shape on top of it. Mm-hmm. And that means that the shape of that public API is inspired by the grammar in the language spec and so on. So the things are very closely tied together, and And a lot of the people on the C# language design team that I lead are compiler people.
That makes sense. That makes total sense. So tell me about your transition from a university, working for a university in Denmark, to suddenly being in the U.S. working for a company. That there had to be some adjustment there.
Oh, yeah. that's putting it mildly. I was blissfully ignorant, let's just say extremely ignorant, about how things even worked in industry. I'd never really set my foot there. And just figuring out what it meant to be a program manager at Microsoft can be a challenge, even for people who have industry experience. It's such a weird, special kind of job description that it takes a while to getting used to. So I kind of had to, you know, figure out a different country, a different culture there, figure out what it meant to work in industry, what business is about, and the whole PM thing, what it meant to own a product, it was overwhelming to me, and it was a really tough transition. I will say that my first 6 months here were not my happiest time. I was I've walked around feeling pretty constantly as a failure, so it was just a lot of learning in
absolutely
at the same time. And I also started out having the compiler PM role, which meant, you know, a lot of driving a software project that was the compiler, and
right.
I was totally unqualified for that.
Right, right.
My qualification really was that I was deep in the programming language thing.
So you understood that part, but you know the yeah. getting a product out on time, bug free, and all that.
I'm like, yeah, I'm totally a fan of getting things out on time and bug-free, but I had no idea what the activities were that you would undertake in order to make that happen.
I hear that.
So some of it was me learning, and some of it was having a manager who was realizing that they weren't really using me for the things I got hired for my strong skills, and creating a new job for me, which was the language PM.
Oh, nice.
C# language PM. We didn't have that notion before, and sort of created that title for me and got somebody else to do the compiler.
That's
and
awesome.
Once we made that switch after, you know, the first 6 months or so, then I really started to hit my stride I could use my core skills and the things that I was good at, and while still, you know, adding value to the company.
Since you run a team, and probably during the 6 months there was some, you know, awkwardness in trying to, you know, acclimate to everything, you know, driving in Seattle traffic over, well, I guess you're used to bridges in Denmark, and, you know, working in English the whole time, even though, you know, you Danes, I think, get more English education than Americans do. I'm curious if there were some people that sort of took you under their wing that mentored you through that process, or maybe you had been through it before.
There certainly were. I think that, well, the manager I had at the time was very helpful, and a few other people on the team. One very important person to mention there. So my manager was, I don't mind saying on air, was Luca Bolognese, who's now back with Microsoft. And even though he fashions himself not a people person, he was totally the right thing for me. He was an immigrant himself to the U.S., and he helped me a lot more than he wants to admit. but, of course, a key person in the whole thing was Anders.
Sure.
Ever since I started, I essentially worked under him. There was never a manager relationship between us per se. Like, he was never actually a people manager, and I was never actually a people manager. We were just program manager. I was a program manager, and he was whatever, distinguished engineer at the time.
Yeah.
But obviously, he was in charge of C#, the language, essentially the way I am now. And And he also was extremely helpful in, we met every week, we still do, getting me, my nose pointed in the right direction and helping me understand things and decode all the weirdness that was happening around me.
Are you able to do that for people on your team now? Now that you sort of became the, you know, comfortable in your own skin, as it were?
Yeah, I think I try to always make room for a few people. I usually have two or three people that I quote unquote mentor. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's like we just meet so that I can help them think about things. And sometimes it's more that we have a collaboration, but I also kind of, you know, help them along. But I try to do the same thing. I know how important it was for me to get mentored and have people supporting me and helping me think things through, decode the weirdness. And I try to do the same for people who are new to Microsoft and new to the role and new to the organization. And a lot of people do. It's something that's in the DNA at Microsoft, and it's a really good part of the culture here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And do you look back at any of the decisions that you sort of made along your career path and wish you had taken another fork, taken another road less traveled, or whatever metaphor I'm misusing?
Yeah. I guess I don't, because if I did, I would be able to tell you right now what those were.
Yeah. And often people have said no, so don't take that as weirdness.
I don't feel pressure to come up with something, but it did take a few twists and turns there. Also, we talked about some of those choices and some of those changes of mind. And I think I'm in a place right now where I continue to have great challenges at work, a great sort of intellectual challenges, growth opportunities, collaboration, which I really appreciate, being able to be on a team and do things together. I was never really a loner. And so it's really hard to regret anything there. I think the thing that had the biggest negative impact, it's still the right decision, but I will say the thing that had the biggest negative impact for me was moving to the United States, just because it's very far away from friends and family that are back in Denmark. And becoming not a two language person so much as a two country person, you're always away from someone that you have a close relationship with. Like we talked about, of course, like, are we going to stay here? Are we going to move back? And when we talked about those things, we realized we've set down just as thick roots here in the United States now. And we will essentially, then it's great to be connected to multiple places in the world, but it comes with that slightly sad undertone of you're always away from something you love.
Yeah. Yeah. So going back would allow you to reconnect with a lot of people that, you know, you miss back in Denmark, but you would leave these friends and maybe family behind that you have in Seattle as well.
Exactly. I have some deep friendships here, and my kids are deeply rooted here. They would probably, if we moved back to Denmark now, they would not all come with us, right? So it's just so we would be leaving family behind to go be with family. That thing you get into. And I, you know, there are a lot of expats here at Microsoft, for instance, and the area in general. And that's just something we all live with. That's, we're always a little, we're split. Our hearts are split between two different places. And it doesn't make it the wrong thing to do. But I want to say that's the specific choice that had the most ramifications on the minus side as well, even though it adds up to a big plus on in the end.
So. That makes total sense. That makes total sense. So let me ask you something I'm personally curious about. One of the nice things about having a podcast is you can bring your own needs into every conversation.
Go for it.
Do you find it more challenging to work on something like C# that is mature and has, you know, millions, maybe billions of lines of code out there that people rely on versus, you know, something like beta where it was very interesting to be sort of digging in the middle of. But if you wanted to try to push it a different direction, you weren't going to break, you know, a billion people's code.
Right. That's a great question. I wanted to just blurt out, yes, it's more challenging because that's a challenge I have. And that we have on the design team that every time you want to add something new, there's more that's already there that you have to figure out all the interactions with. You have to, so both sort of just make sure you don't break anything from a technical perspective, but sure. Also try to stay in the spirit of the language and make it sort of feel like there's continuity. Yeah. So that's it's such a big part of the effort we put into it. It's just making sure that the things we want to do fit into C# and don't break people who are already using it.
That makes a lot of sense.
So obviously that is a big challenge. But thinking about the alternative, which is sort of the greenfield, yeah. I can do whatever I want. What you lack there is you lack a feedback loop of what should I be doing?
Like right.
What is the right next step to take here? If I can do whatever I want, well, I'm probably going to do the wrong thing. So having a strong feedback loop and having a strong sense of direction and
probably philosophy. A community that cares about the language as maybe as much as you do.
Right. That is like literally people whose livelihood depend on it.
Yeah.
That makes it a lot easier to make choices, if you will. Like it's in a sense, a lot more things are given. You know right away, not right away, but you pretty quickly find out if something is a good idea or not before you enact it. So I think that I haven't tried the other thing for a long time, but I think that it's not that this is a bigger challenge. It's just a different kind of challenge.
Sure, I bet. Because you have so many people that are stakeholders in it.
Right.
Yeah. It's interesting because every time there's a new version of C#, I'm an old C++ guy from years back. And every time there's a new C#, I'm so afraid that, like, you know what? We decided type defs or multiple inheritance or pointers for, right. You know, that some evil part of my history in C++ is going to rear its ugly head. And I'm so thankful that Anders and you and the team and everyone has a smarter head on your shoulders than that.
Well, maybe we have a better feedback loop also. I don't know.
It's, I hear that.
It's, I don't. And by the way, I don't want to diss C++. I think it's...
No, not at all.
It's just that it's for a different set of scenarios. But mm-hmm. I think that one of the things that has really been helpful for me coming in to sort of have to take over Anders' role, Anders has magnificent intuition.
Yeah.
And he was good at, and he is now also for TypeScript, but even when we were in that sort of closed world, secret development kind of mode that Microsoft was in when the first many years I was here,
sure.
He was good at predicting what would be the right thing. He was good at putting himself in the developer's shoes and say, oh, they're not going to like it this way. They're going to want it the other way and be right about it. So that was fine. But for me taking over, I don't have nearly the same degree of intuition and nearly the same hit rate that he does. And for me, it's been really important that we've had this opening up of not just the source code, but the whole design process and the discussion about the features that enables us to get more course correction in real time, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I need a lot more input in order to feel confident about a decision.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, this has been absolutely great. Do you have anything else you wanted to add?
I think that's been a great conversation.
Awesome. Awesome. That's the way it feels on this side. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And I know that you're looking at the last 3 days with no rain in Seattle.
No, we have months yet with the... Actually, it rained a bit today, but that was the first time, I think, in a month and a half. And it will be dry again for another month and a half. not as bad as people think. Maybe I shouldn't say that in public. Maybe I should keep it our secret.
Well, it's like people that love Phoenix. They like to tell people that it's 110 all the time to try to keep them out.
Right.
So, I think that's what happens in Seattle.
Yeah.
They're like, oh no, it rains all the time. Stay there. There's already enough traffic. Yeah. Well, you have a great day and thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great.
Thanks for listening to the Hello World Podcast. Remember, you can subscribe to the Hello World Podcast at hwpod.com.